share a problem with virtually every person who has ever lived who decided to take God seriously. Because the question that we all have to face as those who have committed our lives to the Lord Jesus is simply this: how do I live in a world that is opposed to His reign? Now, we often fall into the trap of thinking that others have it easier than we do. Perhaps the man working on a building site thinks it's harder for him in that harsh environment than it is for his friend in the warm company office. His friend in the company office, surrounded by the pressures of perhaps questionable business practices, thinks it must be easier for the teacher. The teacher, under pressure to conform to an increasingly anti-Christian agenda, thinks of a job in the health service. The nurse, surrounded by illness and death, thinks that back at school or college, everything seemed to be a great deal simpler. And the teenager or student experiencing the severe pressures to conform to the activities of their friends and social and sexual values look forward to joining the world of work. Now, this may be a little bit of a caricature, obviously, but wherever else you live in 2012, you live in a hostile world. And if as a Christian you're not actually conscious of that, if the world actually seems quite a comfortable place for you, then could I suggest that you have some serious thinking to do about what you really believe and what its impact is. And so we start tonight a series which we call Dare to be Different, and I have subtitled it Living in a Hostile World. So if you'd like to turn to Daniel chapter 1, we'll read that together. It's on page 883 in the Church Bibles. Daniel chapter 1. In the third year of the reign of Jehoiakim, king of Judah, Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, came to Jerusalem and besieged it. And the Lord delivered Jehoiakim, king of Judah, into his hand, along with some of the articles from the temple of God. These he carried off to the temple of his God in Babylonia and put it in the treasure house of his God. The king ordered Ashpenaz, chief of his court officials, to bring in some of the Israelites from the royal family and nobility, young men without any physical defect, handsome, showing aptitude for every kind of learning, well informed, quick to understand, and qualified to serve in the king's palace. He was to teach them the language and literature of the Babylonians. The king assigned them a daily amount of food and wine from the king's table. They were to be trained for 3 years, and after that they were to enter the king's service. Among these were some from Judah: Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. The chief official gave them new names: to Daniel, the name Belteshazzar; to Hananiah, Shadrach; to Mishael, Meshach; and to Azariah, Abednego. But Daniel resolved not to defile himself with the royal food and wine, and he asked the chief official for permission not to defile himself in this way. Now God had caused the official to show favor and sympathy to Daniel, but the official told Daniel, "I am afraid of my lord the king, who has assigned your food and drink. Why should he see you looking worse than the other young men of your age? The king would then have my head because of you." Daniel said to the guard whom the chief official had appointed over Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, please test your servants for 10 days. Give us nothing but vegetables to eat and water to drink. Then compare our appearance with that of the young men who eat the royal food and treat your servants in accordance with what you see. So he agreed to do this and tested them for 10 days. At the end of the 10 days, they looked healthier and better nourished than any of the young men who ate the royal food. So the guard took away their choice food and their wine they were to drink and gave them vegetables instead. To these 4 young men, God gave knowledge and understanding of all kinds of literature and learning. And Daniel could understand visions and dreams of all kinds. By the end of the time set by the king to bring them in, the chief official presented them to Nebuchadnezzar. The king talked with them, and he found none equal to Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. So they entered the king's service. In every manner of wisdom and understanding about which the king questioned them, he found them 10 times better than all the magicians and enchanters in the whole kingdom. And Daniel remained there until the first year of King Cyrus. And we do believe that God will add his own blessing to the reading of his word, simply because it is his word and not ours. A hostile world. When I was preparing for this, I came across a reference to a newspaper article which had been written just over 2 years ago by the historian A.N. Wilson. And I was interested enough in the reference to do these wonderful things you can do in the computer now and actually find it. It's so much better than even the cursory filing system in my office at home. You can find things 2.5 years ago. I can't find things 2.5 hours ago. However, I found this article published in a national newspaper in 2009. It was A.N. Wilson reflecting on his return to faith from years in which he was virulently anti-Christian. And I'd like to read quite an extensive little extract of it to you. See if this rings any bells in the world that you live in. For much of my life, I too have been one of those who did not believe. It was in my young manhood that I began to wonder how much of the Easter story I accepted, and in my 30s I lost any religious belief whatsoever. Like many people who lost faith, I felt anger with myself for having been conned by such a story. I began to rail against Christianity and wrote a book entitled Jesus, which endeavoured to establish that he had been no more than a messianic prophet who had well and truly failed and died. Let me ask the question, why did I, along with so many, become so dismissive of Christianity? Like most educated people in Britain and Northern Europe, I have grown up in a culture that is overwhelmingly secular and anti-religious. The universities, the broadcasters and media generally are not merely non-religious, they are positively anti. To my shame, I believe it was this that made me lose faith and heart in my youth. It felt so uncool to be religious. With the mentality of a child in the playground, I felt at some visceral level that being religious was unsexy, like having spots or wearing glasses. This playground attitude accounts for much of the attitude towards Christianity that you pick up, say, from alternative comedians and the casual light blasphemy of jokes on TV or radio. It also lends weight to the fervour of the anti-God fanatics, such as the writer Christopher Hitchens, who has since died, and the geneticist Richard Dawkins, who think that all the evil in the world is actually caused by religion. The vast majority of media pundits and intelligentsia in Britain are unbelievers, many of them quite fervent in their hatred of religion itself. For 10 or 15 of my middle years, I too was one of the mockers. But as time passed, I found myself going back to church, although at first only as a fellow traveller with the believers, not as one who shared the faith that Jesus had truly risen from the dead. Sometime over the past 5 or 6 years, I could not tell you exactly when, I found that I had changed. My own return to faith has surprised no one more than myself. Why did I return to it? Partially, perhaps, it is no more than the confidence I have gained with age. Rather than being cowed by them, I relish the notion that by asserting a belief in the risen Christ, I am defying all the liberal clever clogs on the block. Cutting-edge novelists such as Martin Amos, foul-mouthed, self-satisfied TV presenters such as Jonathan Ross and Joe Brand, and the smug, tireless architects of so much television output. But there is more to it than that. My belief has come about in large measure because of the lives and examples of people I have known. Not the famous, not saints, but friends and relations who have lived and faced death in light of the resurrection story, or in the quiet acceptance that they have a future after they die. It's a wonderful story. But I tell you it not so much for the wonder of the story, however heartwarming that is, but I tell you because it reflects our world. That is the world we live in. That is the world your children go to school in. That is the world our colleagues work in. That is the world your TV programs and newspapers are formed in. That is the world in which the soap operas are produced. That is the world in which the football crowds live. That is a hostile world if you are a Christian today. But if you think the world is hostile and your boss is tough, then please come with me to Daniel's world. The world of 605 BC in Babylon. King Nebuchadnezzar is assembling one of the greatest empires that the world has ever seen. His city is vast. The walls round it are 18 kilometers long, and so wide that 2 4-horse chariots can pass each other on the top of the wall without having to look for a lay-by. The architectural and artistic achievements are symbolized by structures such as the Hanging Gardens of Babylon, which are a wonder to this very day. There are 1,000 temples to a variety of pagan gods, and Nebuchadnezzar has defeated his last mega rival, the Empire of Egypt. And in a wiping up operation, a cleaning up operation, he has besieged Jerusalem, the capital of the tiny remnant state of Judah. Judah was the last remnant of David's vast and wonderful kingdom. But after a split in the kingdom and a succession of bad kings and absolute rebellion to God and turning away to idolatry, Judah is now besieged. It's a vassal state of Babylon, robbed even of the very articles in God's temple. and Nebuchadnezzar will return in later years to finish the job and burn down the temple. Now, to the inhabitants of Judea, this is beyond disaster. This is beyond comprehension. Because if you were looking carefully at the very first two verses we read, we noticed that it wasn't Nebuchadnezzar who achieved all of this, but God. The Lord delivered Jehoiakim, king of Judah, into his hand. A disaster of unbelievable proportions. We cannot even begin to enter into it. And yet we are told that God brought it about. Nebuchadnezzar was a clever emperor. He realized that if you spent all your time punishing people and keeping them down, then ultimately you would build up enough tension and bad feeling for a possible rebellion. So he has taken the cream of the society of the various nations he has conquered, including the Judean youth, with a view to turning them into Babylonians, into loyal Babylonians, and using them to exercise his power. It's a tactic that successful empires, including the British Empire, used ever since then. They took the best of the population of the countries they had colonized, and they trained them to be Babylonians, or in our history, trained them to be British. This, as far as Nebuchadnezzar was concerned, was not going to be any sort of a multicultural society. He will educate them, he will train them, he will sustain them, he will give them top jobs in the empire, but they will be Babylonians. And four young men, taken from their homes, they were probably 14 years old. These weren't guys in their 20s. They were probably 14 years old because that was the age at which Babylonian university education began, if you want to put it in those terms, are taken from their families, they're taken from their religion, they're taken from all visible means of support, in an environment where absolutely nobody believes what they believe, in a regime where dissent is death. Now, how are they to live in that hostile world? Well, they need, I think you would agree, at the very least, godly wisdom. You see, when confronted by such hostility over the years, the history of the Christian church has often centered on a number of strategies for living in a hostile world. Let me just remind you of one or two of them. I have called them failed strategies. One of the strategies is withdrawal. And I suppose, to be honest, that was the tradition that would most have described the way I grew up. Withdrawal says the world is a nasty, sinful, dangerous place, so we will withdraw to our Christian community and those who agree with us. We will isolate ourselves as far as possible from anyone who is not converted and live in what we see as holy isolation. And we grab a verse which says, come out and be separate, pull it out of context, and that is our reason for doing it. But in doing that, we ignore, of course, that Jesus prayed, my prayer is not that you would take them out of the world, but that you would protect them from the evil one. We ignore that Paul said, I have written to you in my letter not to associate with sexually immoral people, not at all meaning the people of this world who are immoral or greedy and swindlers or idolaters. In this case, you would have to leave the world, 1 Corinthians 5, 9-12. And we ignore Peter, whom we read tonight, who said, live such good lives among the pagans that though they accuse you of doing wrong, they may see your good works and glorify God. That is a strategy that Christians use to this day. Now, of course, there are places where Christians should not go. Of course, there are activities that we cannot and should not enter into. Of course, we prize Christian fellowship. It is one of the great graces that God has given us. But He did not save us to withdraw from the world in which we live. The second strategy that has been used over the years is the strategy of confrontation. There are those who, so conscious of the sins of the world, decide to make themselves as loud and awkward and disagreeable and condemnatory as possible. They parade, they wave placards, they criticize and they condemn. In extremis, I suppose, in America, they become those who bomb hospitals where abortions are carried out. Now, I must tell you, I see none of this in the way Jesus behaved or spoke or in the teaching of His apostles. We are to be salt and light, and that's where our irritation comes from. That's how we irritate and affect the society we live in. Not by being judges and jury. And then sadly, there are those for which the strategy is absorption. For many, their attitude is this: we are in Babylon, we didn't choose to be here, but let's make the best of it. Join in, be a part of whatever's going on, keep a low profile. We are quiet Christians. And before too long, any Christian distinctives have disappeared. Apart from an obviously fairly unconvinced visit to church on an irregular basis, they cannot be distinguished in any meaningful way from decent society around them. And sadly, many Christians live like that today. They are Christians because they say they are Christians, but looking on from outside, it would be hard-pressed to find the evidence sometimes. And to be honest, let's face it, that covers all of us at some time or another. So how are these four young men to live? It seems to me that they followed none of these strategies. You will probably have heard many, many sermons in Daniel 1 which have emphasized about how Daniel refused the king's food. And we'll come to that in a minute because that is very much a key part of the chapter. But before we do that, look at the things he said yes to. We might call Daniel's strategy cooperation without compromise. As you saw, the king was intent in creating Babylonians, and he used a four-part approach: education, maintenance, reward, and identity. That was his strategy. We educate them, we keep them, we reward them, and we give them a new identity. And when we have worked through that process in this intensive university atmosphere, we will have our loyal Babylonians. The three-year course at Babylon University, one of the best in the world at the time, was to cover language and literature. It would have included all manner of pagan instructions: sorcery, astrology, enchantment, magic, and no doubt an intensive course on the multitude of Babylonian gods. The young man raised no objection. Indeed, as we find out 3 years later, with God's specific enabling, they excelled beyond the other students. But not only did they accept a pagan education, they accepted jobs from a pagan king. These were the senior civil servants of the day. These were the men responsible for implementing government policy with all the perks and accolades that go with that. And they raised no objection to having these jobs. Indeed, they continued on a lifetime of service in Babylon. And what is perhaps even more disturbing to us coming to this with our preset ideas is that they raised no objection whenever their names were changed. And each one of their names was a godly name. Daniel meant God is just. Hananiah meant the grace of Yahweh. Mishael meant who is what God is. Azariah meant strengthened by Yahweh. And each one of these names was taken from them, and they were given a name which reflected a reference to a Babylonian god. So they went from, not just from godly names to neutral names, they went from godly names to ungodly names. Think about how you would feel if you applied for a visa to go and live in, say, a Muslim country. And you were told that, yes, you can go, but one condition is that you will be known as Muhammad. How would you feel? Would you say that's one step too far? That's what happened. But you see, perhaps Daniel had read what Jeremiah had said. Because Jeremiah gave him very clear instructions. This is what he said. This is what the Lord Almighty, the God of Israel, says to all those who are carried into exile from Jerusalem to Babylon. That's the audience. Build houses and settle down. Plant gardens and eat what they produce. Marry and have sons and daughters. Find wives for your sons and give your daughters in marriage so that they may have sons and daughters. Increase in number there. Do not decrease. Also seek the peace and prosperity of the city to which I have carried you into exile. Pray to the Lord for it, because if it prospers, you will prosper. Surely this is saying something to us about how we interact with the world we live in. Not by withdrawal, not by confrontation, certainly not by absorption. But somewhere in all of this, the godly man and woman finds how to cooperate without compromise. You see, every single one of us living in this hostile world, trying to live by the instructions and standards of God, will get to a point where a line has to be drawn. And if in your Christian life you have never been in a situation where you haven't had to draw a line at something, then I kind of doubt that you've got the root of the salvation question in your mind. Speak to some of the older Christians in this building tonight, and they will tell you of the numerous times over the course of their lives where they have had to say, or they have felt that God wanted them to say, sorry, that's a step too far. Can't do that. I can't ring up and tell them the check's in the post, because the check is not in the post, and that's a lie. In this particular situation, I cannot drink alcohol because that would not be the right thing for me to do. I'm sorry, I can't go to your party because what goes on in your party is not something that I can countenance. I'm sorry, I'm not going to watch that television program because that television program demeans my God. Every Christian lives a life of having
to draw lines. Now, why did Daniel, with these four things to choose from, choose food? In many ways, it seems the least significant of the four.
And yet, that is what he chose.
And the reason why he chose it is something that nobody is quite certain of the answer.
Some people have suggested that it was to do with the very strict and specific Jewish food laws, which was a real distinctive in their way of life.
But that doesn't really hold water because the vegetables would have been unclean under those laws as well, because they would not have been prepared in a kosher way.
And in the Levitical laws, there actually was no prohibition on wine at all.
So there may be something in that, but it's not the whole answer, certainly.
Some people have suggested that it was to do with the fact that food would have been offered to idols.
But then the vegetables wouldn't have been excluded from that procedure either.
Perhaps it was, and I think this is the one that to me carries the most conviction, perhaps it was because in that culture, whenever you ate at the king's table, you were assenting to be the king's bond person.
You were saying, I am declaring my allegiance and my service to the king exclusively. Perhaps it was that, but the truth of the matter is that nobody really knows. The point is that a line was drawn. A personal line was drawn. There's no suggestion that this is the particular line that everyone has to draw. This is not a sermon or a passage which preaches vegetarianism. But it was a line that somehow or other Daniel knew had to be drawn.
In fact, whenever we get to chapter 10 and verse 3, we find that many years later, Daniel had no such qualms about the food he was eating, this stuff. So perhaps it was just a line for this 3 years at university. We really don't know.
The dean of the university, although sympathetic, turned down his request for reasons of personal safety. And so he negotiates a trial period with the next level down. And God honours his servant's stand. And the question for me, for you this evening is, where am I currently drawing the line?
It's clear that Daniel and his friends had not taken this stand right at the beginning of their careers in Babylon, in a very seemingly unimportant matter like food, it would have been very difficult for him to take a stand when it came to issues like the lion's den and the fiery furnace.
If you're going to a new job, if you're going to a new school, if you're going to university, if you're going with a new set of friends, if you're joining a new golf club, if you're doing any of these things and a whole lot more I haven't thought of, where you draw that line sets you up for where you will go within that context. Fail to draw the line at the beginning, and you'll find it so very, very difficult to draw the line later. Here's another question, and just going to take another 5 minutes if you don't mind, because this is an important question. How do you think Daniel, a 14-year-old boy, knew where the line had to be drawn in this particular situation? How do you think he knew? Well, we're not told. But let me give you a suggestion. Religious life back in Judah had been pretty polluted since the times of Josiah, the last good king. So I would suggest that he most probably got it from his home. If you come to this church on a regular basis, you will know that when we dedicate a child on our Sunday morning service, we tend to read a passage from Deuteronomy. This is what it says. These commandments I give you, this is addressed to parents, today are to be upon your hearts. Impress them on your children. Talk about them when you sit at home and when you walk along the road, when you lie down and when you get up. Tie them as symbols on your hands and bind them upon your foreheads. Write them on the door frames of your houses and on your gates. What's it saying? In your home, what do you talk about? What do you talk to your children about? What did I talk to my children about? I'm a parent. How often did I talk to them about? Did I take every opportunity, or was it just something I squeezed in on a Sunday morning because it sort of, you know, fit it in on a Sunday morning or on Sunday lunch? Tie them as symbols on your hands. What did they see me actually do? What were my actions? As my boys grew up in my house, what did they see when they looked at how I lived my life? Bind them on your foreheads. What do they observe about the way you think? The values you have. Write them on the door frames of your houses and of your gates. Is family life in the McCracken household something that prepares my children to go into Babylon? And you know, from they were about 12, they went into Babylon every day when they went to school, as your children do. Eventually they went into Babylon in university. And then they went into Babylon in the world of work. And they're still there, just like me and you here this evening. As parents, if your child was asked by somebody who they were free to give an absolutely honest answer to, what were the priorities when you were growing up? What would they say? Would they talk about education, how they were pressed to work hard and get good exam results? Would they talk about their sporting achievements and how they were encouraged to participate in sport and do it really, really well? Would they talk about the advice to get a career where they could earn good money and be secure? I've never had the nerve to ask my boys that question. But that's the question to ask. And I would suggest to you that that is where Daniel got the basis for cooperation without compromise. As I said, our children go into Babylon every day when they leave home to go to school, when they really leave home to go to work or university, when they choose a wife or a husband, and are we confident that we have provided them with the basis to know where the line should be drawn? I have wanted to finish by just pointing out that God appears three times in this chapter. The same word is used each time. The Lord delivered or gave Jehoiakim into the hand of Nebuchadnezzar. The Lord caused the official or gave the official sympathy towards Daniel in verse 19. And God gave the three young men the ability to learn. In all of this apparent mess, God is sovereign and at work. And so I leave you with three personal questions for each of us. Some apply more to one than another. Personal questions are these. Do I recognize the world I live in as being a hostile place? If I think it's an okay sort of place, then it's going to have me very quickly. What lines do I draw? And where do I draw them? and on what basis do I make that decision? And for parents, how am I preparing my children? The world of 605 BC had an awful lot of similarities to 2012 AD.